For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and to mark this, our 250th episode, today we're celebrating libraries and museums and the free access to knowledge and joy that they give us all. We go back in time to uncover the untold history of the talking book and the roots of the RNIB library. Robert Kirkwood gets a fascinating insight into the fragile history of libraries throughout the ages. Philip Carnegie Medal shortlisted author Joseph Coelho discusses the vital role that libraries have played in his life. And museum expert Rachel Morris tells Robert what she found in the boxes under her bed. That's all coming up on today's Read On. As befits a show about museums and libraries, this edition contains some things old and some things new. So let's begin at the beginning, with my very first interview for Read On. And appropriately enough, it concerned the untold history of the talking book.
We've come a long way since the days when people imagined hearing an entire novel through a phonograph tucked into the ears of their hats. But it's a story that lay forgotten in the archives until it was rediscovered by a professor of modern literature, Matthew Rubery. And through writing the untold history of the talking book, he unearthed more than even he could have dreamed of. And it all started with a nursery rhyme.
The history of talking books goes back much farther than most people realize. That's all the way back to the early days of sound recording technology. When Thomas Edison invented the phonograph in 1877, the first thing he recorded was the nursery rhyme, Mary Had a Little Lamb. And ever since then, spoken word recordings have been made for people's entertainment.
And from that tin foil phonograph, what was the next stage?
Well, Edison did get it right that he foresaw the phonograph being used to record books for blind people. So he was absolutely right. However, he was wildly optimistic that it would happen in his lifetime. It would be another 50 years before full-length recordings of books could be made. The original phonograph could record 2 or 3 minutes of speech. So you could record excerpts of poems or short poems, soliloquies from Shakespeare, let's say, but nothing close to a full-length book. So you have lots of short recordings for the next 50 years, but nothing much longer. It would wait until the 1930s and the talking book program for blind people before talking books became a realistic possibility. So the first phonograph Edison invented was a tinfoil cylinder, and it was a great novelty. People loved it, but it wasn't very practical. Once the tinfoil came off the cylinder, it was basically lost. So 10 years later, a new and improved phonograph came out that used wax cylinders to record people's speech. It was on those cylinders that a lot of the recordings we know today, say by Alfred Tennyson or Robert Browning, those are made on that new and improved phonograph. So long playing records are the big breakthrough. Captain Ian Fraser at Blind Veterans UK had been experimenting for years trying to figure out a way to get discs to record more than just a few minutes. He worked with the Royal National Institute of Blind People. He worked with record companies to try to get this technology ready. But it would take a long time to do that. And it wasn't until the 1930s that you get the first long-playing records that could record 20 to 24 minutes of speech. That's 10 or 15 years ahead of the commercial market, though. So I think this is a rare example of people with disabilities getting a technology before everybody else.
Gosh, that's quite revolutionary. And presumably this was due to the sheer number of veteran soldiers blinded in the First World War, the sheer demand.
That's absolutely right. Ian Fraser was one of those soldiers who got shot through the eyes by a German sniper in the First World War and came back to work with other veterans. And there was a real push to try to find a way to provide entertainment for the large number of veterans that came back from the First World War and had lost their sight. The technology was obviously beneficial to civilians too, but even though people have been looking for ways to help blind people to read for over a century at this point, this influx of veterans really gave the push to try to find some way to assist people who'd sacrificed their eyesight defending the country.
While it's important to think about the talking book in relation to its print predecessors, we should also try to understand the format in its own terms. The talking book only exists because a group of people had no access to books at the beginning of the 20th century. Media historians have long recognized the link between disability and invention. The book was simply inadequate when it came to meeting the needs of people with disabilities. The obvious solution was to adapt the book into alternative formats suitable for these readers.
One of the questions I always get from people is who chose the books, and then also sort of how did they choose them? The titles that were chosen, initially there was a policy of 75% of the titles being classics of enduring value, and then 25% could be more recreational reading. And that was partly a budget decision. Not many books could be recorded, and no one wanted to record books that would be forgotten in 6 months. But the people who were reading those books often just wanted contemporary bestsellers, the same things everybody else was reading. They didn't want people telling them what was good for them to be reading, and they protested that they wanted to be able to decide for themselves what books to read. The first titles that were recorded included a sort of mix. Joseph Conrad's Typhoon, Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and The Gospel According to St. John. And that's a nice mix, because Agatha Christie was a bestseller at the time. She was on a lot of popular reading lists. Joseph Conrad's book was slightly older, but he still had a popular reputation then. And the Bible has always been the most popular talking book. The book of talking books, as I like to call it, and seemed to please a lot of people, including funders.
And were these books funded by donations from bodies, such as quite a lot of the talking books nowadays are, or were they funded by the RNIB?
I've gone over these early lists of books recorded, and at first they're difficult to make sense of because it's not just a list of great books to be recorded. A number of the early titles were recorded by outside agencies. The Gospel According to St. John was subsidized by an outside group. They wanted to record a section of the Bible. They chose that one because it coincided with the anniversary of the Venerable Bede's death that year. So there were practical decisions like that. Some patrons of the Talking Book Library chose titles that were meaningful to them. They might say, pick a Dickens title and have that recorded. So you going through these lists, it's not always clear at first glance which ones were chosen based on popularity and which ones were chosen based on individual tastes. It's always a contentious issue because not many books could be recorded, so you always had to be very careful in which ones you did choose. There was always a policy of not censoring titles, but at the same time, a lot of controversial titles were not recorded because it was just easier to record safer choices. So you almost have an informal censorship for a number of years. And a lot of people believed that listening to books was a more intimate experience than reading them in print or braille, and therefore potentially more offensive. And I'm not just talking about sort of prurient books. I mean, we're talking about some what we think of as classic literature today. So Muriel Spark's The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, for instance, Alan Sillitoe's work, Marcel Proust's work. Those were all considered a bit too risque. So that was another issue that was very controversial for the first few decades.
And actually, the flip side of that now is that sometimes you'll listen to recordings made in the 50s and 60s where language that no one would dream of using now to do with race is included, and it's very strange hearing that read out to you nowadays, whereas actually I think were you reading it, it might be easier to skip over the word or ignore it or pretend you hadn't seen it.
I completely agree. I mean, I do think hearing material read aloud is more forceful in many cases than reading it in print. And certainly hearing outdated forms of speech, say, that are considered controversial today or considered inappropriate today, hearing that read aloud does strike me much more forcefully than skimming over it in print, say. And anytime people bring up talking books or audiobooks, it seems to be an invitation to debate the nature of reading. I would say that reading is actually much more complex and capacious than we usually give it credit for. So I would still count listening to a book as reading and just say that there is no one experience of reading. We can sort of count reading print with our eyes, reading print with our fingers, or listening to books with our ears, all under that term. Talking Book Libraries for Blind People historically have tried to make that experience as close to print as possible so that it would be treated as equivalent to reading and blind people would not be seen as any different from anybody else. But I think there are opportunities too. And I think historically there have been some really fascinating experiments with what can make a listening experience even better than a print experience.
Such as?
All the books I've heard clips from in the last 10 years really do a great job of using accents. So I recently heard the Trainspotting recording that has a very thick Glaswegian accent. And again, for someone who's not native to Britain, hearing that accent used to speak the words was much more compelling to me than just reading those words to myself and trying to imagine what that accent would sound like.
Oh, believe you me, as a Brit trying to read that book in print form back in 1992 or whatever it was, I would have loved somebody reading it to me because I couldn't make head nor tail of it. I mean, I think we live in exciting times. I think the fact that there is now a lot more simultaneous publication of the traditional print copy and the audiobook copy of new books, finally blind and partially sighted people are being served equally fairly by the publishers.
There's never been a better time to be a talking book reader. There's a lot more willingness on the part of publishers to experiment with audiobooks, talking books as their own art form and try to really enhance the reading experience. I think it's exciting to see the new recordings that are coming out, and I think the quality of recorded books has never been better.
I couldn't agree more. Now, just reeling us back 80 years to 1935, there's been some very exciting news. You donned your detective hat, and you have managed to track down, I think now, two of the first three recordings. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I've been searching for the first talking books recorded in Britain for years now. Unfortunately, the first five books that were recorded, all those records have been lost or destroyed, as far as I could tell. I looked around Britain, I looked around America, but it wasn't until I corresponded with a vintage record collector in Canada that one of these records turned up. I'd been corresponding with him for a couple of years without knowing that he had any of these records in his possession. He read an article of mine describing the history of talking books in Britain and got in touch with me, sent me a list and said, I have some of these old recordings. Are you interested in any of them? I saw Joseph Conrad's Typhoon on the list, one of the very first talking books made, perhaps the very first talking book ever made in Britain, and nearly jumped out of my socks. I mean, it was a happy day. He since agreed to record that record for the British Library so we can save this valuable part of our cultural heritage. He sent me a short clip so we can get a taste of what it's like. And it really gives us a sense of how the standards of narration have changed over the years. Anthony MacDonald, who reads that one, does it in, you know, good old RP, a very formal way of reading the books that is very different from what we're used to today, where reading styles tend to be much more conversational. So hearing those first recordings made, you know, just gives me a shiver down the spine. It's so exciting to get that glimpse into the past.
Captain McQuire of the steamer Nan Shan had a physiognomy that in the order of material appearances was the exact counterpart of his mind. It presented no marked characteristics of firmness or stupidity. It had no pronounced characteristics whatever. It was simply ordinary, irresponsive, and unruffled.
And off the back of that, I hear that also the Gospel According to St. John has turned up. Was that the same record collector?
This is a different one. A British collector does have the first disc of that collection, so we do have a sample of it at least. And it gives me hope that perhaps Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd will turn up in somebody's loft at some point.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Matt Rubery. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
So thanks to Matthew Rubery for showing us how the cultural history of blind people has helped shape the course of modern publishing. You can find Matthew's book as an audiobook, available commercially.
And since that feature was made, Matt Rubery has discovered conclusive evidence that Anthony MacDonald did indeed record The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, as well as Typhoon. Although which of them was recorded first, and so can claim to be the first talking book, remains a mystery. You're listening to a special edition of Read On. This week, we're focusing on the vital role that libraries and museums play in providing us with public access to information and culture. Coming up later, poet and author Joseph Coelho reveals his enduring love for public libraries, and museum expert Rachel Morris tells Robert what she found lurking under her bed. But first, here is Robert Kirkwood.
famed across the known world, jealously guarded by private collectors, built up over centuries, destroyed in a single day, ornamented with gold leaf and frescoes, or filled with beanbags and children's drawings. The history of the library is rich, varied, and stuffed full of incident.
Today, public libraries face falling budgets and the maintenance costs of old and decaying buildings, at the same time as demands for new services and declining interest in their legacy collections. During our research for this book, we witnessed at first hand the struggle over the Durning Public Library in Kennington, which Lambeth Council planned to turn into a community resource. Council speak for defunding it and allowing it to be run by volunteers. This ran into determined resistance from a group of local residents campaigning to keep it open. Does the campaign represent public-spirited altruism that we should applaud? Or is it a nostalgia for a world that has now disappeared and will never return?
In this, the first major history of its kind, Andrew Pettigrew and Arthur de Verivin explore the contested and dramatic history of the library. From the famous collections of the ancient world to the embattled public resources we cherish today. I met both Arthur and Andrew at the Wigtown Book Festival.
Well, hello, I'm Arthur de Verivin. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of St Andrews and I'm a historian and writer.
I'm Andrew Pettigrew. I'm a professor of modern history at the University of St Andrews, and together with Arthur, I've written The Library of Fragile History.
The educated and affluent part of our community takes it for granted that public funding of the arts and the facilitation of recreational reading is part of the core functions of government. But the public library, in the sense of a funded collection available free to anyone who wants to use it, has only existed since the mid-19th century. A mere fraction of the history of the library as a whole. If there is one lesson from the centuries-long story of the library, it is that libraries only last as long as people find them useful.
It's a history of libraries and book collecting from ancient Greece to Google. So we cover a lot of ground in our 18 chapters. but it's been a very interesting project because I think we've demonstrated that although most histories of libraries concentrate on beautiful buildings and great collections, it's actually been private libraries, personal collecting, which has really driven the story of book collecting.
Today, are libraries under threat?
They certainly are, but I think the point of us writing this book, the story that we wanted to tell, is to frame the current crises of libraries, funding cuts, closures, even the pandemic we're going through right now, to frame that in a much longer history of library crises. In fact, the library as a concept has always in some way been under threat.
In the book, you describe collections being destroyed. Is that heartbreaking when you find out about these?
Well, there's been a lot of books which have described the bombing of libraries and the destruction of libraries. And of course, these are individual tragedies. But far more destruction goes on through the mundane process of libraries weeding their stock each year to provide space. Libraries are created, they're enhanced, and then they're dispersed and recreated elsewhere. And it's that everyday story of evolution that we've concentrated on most in our book.
In other words, libraries need to adapt to survive, as they have always adapted to survive, a feat very successfully accomplished in recent years in France with its network of médiathèques, albeit with a huge commitment of public funds. University libraries, responding to student demand, are now social hubs as much as places of work. The cathedral silence that once characterized the library a thing of the past. In this, libraries actually hark back to an earlier model pioneered in the Renaissance, when libraries were often convivial social spaces in which books jostled for attention alongside paintings, sculptures, coins, and curiosities. This history of libraries does not offer a story of easy progress through the centuries, nor a prolonged lament for libraries lost. A repeating cycle of creation and dispersal, decay and reconstruction, turns out to be the historical norm.
The people who work in libraries
are usually female, but the person at the top's usually male. Has it always been that sort of a sexist industry?
For a very long time, the staff of libraries was exclusively male, especially for great institutional libraries. If you're thinking here, for example, of libraries in monasteries, in the early universities, these were very much male domains. So you really see the rise of the sort of the feminization of the library at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And yes, there has certainly been the case that the hierarchy within those libraries has often been warped, like you described. Like the top administrators are male, but the vast majority of the actual staff are female. But women have, in that role, exercised enormous influence over readers and borrowers in the library. You don't necessarily need to be right at the top of the leadership in order to be able to have a meaningful influence on the collections.
And I would say that it is very different in different countries. The United States was much quicker than Great Britain to feminize its profession. And if you go to France now, 80% of the staff of the municipal libraries are now women, but so are most of the directors. So that's a profession in France where women have risen absolutely to the top of the profession.
Now, if there was a library you could visit that's no longer with us, what one would it be?
Well, I think out of sure sort of emotional attachment, and one of the things that you described earlier about the sadness of destruction of libraries, I would have loved to have visited one of the sort of the great Polish libraries before the Second World War and in the interwar period. Because I think when you're talking about the deliberate destruction of libraries, it's in the Second World War with the Nazi destruction of the cultural heritage of Central and Eastern Europe that you see sort of the greatest crime against books. So to just walk around those collections and see books which almost all of them were entirely destroyed, we've lost so much there that would be a real privilege to be able to see that and take something in.
I think I'd take the auction catalogue of one of the Dutch libraries of the 17th century, and I'd go back 300 years and then knock on the door and ask to see where this person was keeping 2,000 books in an ordinary townhouse, because very few private libraries survive as they were experienced by their owners. But in the case of the Dutch, there are an awful lot of auction catalogues which give you a sort of second-hand view, but they don't tell us anything about where they kept their books.
Even if libraries are cherished, the contents of these collections require constant curation and often painful decisions about what is continuing value and what must be disposed of. Very often libraries flourished in the hands of their first owner and then wasted away. Damp, dust, moths and bookworm do far more damage over the years than the targeted destruction of libraries. But while growth and decline are parts of the cycle, so too is recovery. In 1556, the University of Oxford, its book collection despoiled, sold off the library's furniture. 50 years later, Sir Thomas Bodley established the greatest university library of the next 3 centuries. Fire ravaged libraries with remarkable frequency, only for the collections to be rebuilt more easily with each passing generation, as the number of books available on the open market multiplied. This is a story, then, of many unexpected twists and turns.
The library, a fragile history, and it picks up of this theme we've running through it of how vulnerable libraries are, but they always bounce back. And very unusually, Profile, our publishers, wrote to us to ask who we'd like to do the audiobook. And they gave us the sample of 3 different people's work so that we could choose between them. And frankly, as an author, you very seldom get that sort of consideration from publishers. But it's Sean Barrett, who's our reader. And I have to say that he's got a most beautiful voice. And I'm sure he's done a good job. When I spoke to our publisher about this and said, thank you for asking, I said, they do get trouble because sometimes authors say they want to do it themselves without realizing just what a difficult job it is to do.
So you didn't fancy reading it yourself?
No, certainly not. And I think given we've got co-authorship on this book, we had such a fun time writing it together. But I think if we both had to read it, who knows what conflict might arise.
Now,
The Library, A Fragile History by Arthur Devedevin and Andrew Pettigrew is available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks.
Thanks, Robert. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, as we've just heard, libraries continue to play a vital role in the lives of many people, not least among them poet and author Joseph Coelho, who was shortlisted for last year's Philip Carnegie Medal. The annual award recognises outstanding literature for children. It's run by CILIP, the Library and Information Association, and part of the prize is the donation of £500 worth of books to the winning author's library of choice. Joseph Coelho's novel in verse, The Girl Who Became a Tree, was one of the books in contention, and when I interviewed him about it, he was keen to tell me just how important libraries are to him. Joe, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. Lovely to be here.
To set the scene for The Girl Who Became a Tree, could I ask you to read the opening poem, please?
Absolutely. It's called A Story of a Girl. A story of a girl with a hurt she can't express. A tale of a creature, a tale of deepest red. A journey in a library where a forest lurks. A message that is stolen. A fable of growing hurt.
Daphne, who is the main character, is grieving. Her father has recently died and she finds solace in her local library.
In a nutshell, yeah, she's very much been isolating herself from her family and friends and has always been a regular to her local library, as indeed I was growing up. But of late, the librarian has noticed that she started to come in alone. She's no longer answering messages from her friends. She's doing her best to alienate her mother. So she's just, I guess, closing herself off as a defense mechanism to deal with this grieving process. But through doing that and through doing it in a library, it opens her up to another world where other things lurk.
Yes, without giving away any spoilers, there is a bit of a Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe moment in the library.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that because that was a massive kind of inspiration for me growing up. I loved The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, from the films to the TV series and to the books, which I've read several times. And that idea that you can go through a door, go through a wardrobe and enter into another world, I always found really fascinating as a child. But growing up in one of Europe's largest council estates and not having a big, huge, wooden, ornately carved wardrobe, it always felt a bit distant, like that magical world maybe wasn't for me. And so it had an extra appeal in that it felt that much further away and a sort of sadness connected with that. But it's always been something I've wanted to connect with through my writing, to let young people know that doors to other worlds are all around us.
And as you say, nowhere is that more true than in a library. You open something which is, well, wood pulp and step into another world.
Exactly. Yeah.
And another inspiration for the story of Daphne is the ancient Greek myth of the nymph Daphne, who is trying to escape from the god Apollo.
Yeah, it felt like the sort of ideal myth to interweave with this story, because Daphne in the original Greek myth is trying to escape the attention of Apollo, who is in love with her and is chasing her, but also in my interpretation is the symbol. Apollo represents healing and the arts and life, and so I sort of see that myth as Daphne the nymph trying to turn away, to stay nest bound, to stay with the father, to not enter out into the big wide world. She ends up begging her river godfather Peneus to transform her into a tree so that she can stay rooted, stay stuck by his side. And in a similar way, my Daphne is wanting to hold on to the past because she's grieving her father and she doesn't want to move on. As I think any of us that have suffered grief, experienced grief, know that feeling of wanting to hold on to the past and to not move on with, the idea of moving on becomes a very difficult concept. So it felt like an ideal way to show that through that Greek retelling side by side with this more modern story.
Well, yes, and one of the things I do love about this book is that you do retell the Greek myth, both in your own story, but the original myth is printed on different coloured paper within the pages of the book.
Yeah, it felt important to give it its own space because it's like a thematic thread, which I first started exploring in my first kind of older poetry collection, Overheard in a Tower Block, which was also illustrated by Kate Milner, as is The Girl Who Became a Tree. And the myth I kind of thread through that collection is the story of Prometheus, the Titan who stole fire and gave it to humanity. And I've always been attracted to myths and fairy tales because there's something quite primal about them, that archetypal symbols that we recognize and sometimes unconsciously recognize. And so I find very powerful ways of underlining and supporting a narrative and drawing out further ideas and themes in a story.
And of course, the original Greek myths would have been told and sung by bards and would have been a performance and poetry, which is exactly what you're doing, because this is a novel told in verse.
Yeah, I really want to challenge myself in writing this to put poetry at the forefront. And that's why I call it a story told in poems, as opposed to being cut up prose, which I love. There's been a huge kind of surge in popularity with verse novels, which I absolutely adore. And their strength, I think, is telling story in a kind of prosaic way, which just flows. But I really want to get back to poetry and to different forms of poems and poems as being mediums that are designed to be heard and that use all those wonderful poetic devices like metaphor and simile and alliteration, as well as the various forms that are available to tell a story. Because, yeah, the narrative and story was originally sung. We had ballads and epic poems told around the fire, and I think reconnecting with that helps the storytelling process, helps that connection between writer and reader.
And you have really challenged yourself to write in as many different forms as possible in the book, including limericks, a key-shaped poem, and a concrete poem. Could you describe that for the listeners, please?
Yeah, so the concrete poem, the shape poem, is in the shape of a key, which is very important in the narrative. Daphne goes to the library often after school, but on this particular evening, she has to go because her mum, who works as a nurse, has taken the spare key. So she's a bit of a latchkey kid, you know, will come home, take the key from under the rock, third rock to the left on the patio, and lets herself into the house. But her mum's taken the only spare key, and so she has to wait for her mum to finish work. So she's in the library quite late, and we overhear a conversation she has with her mother on the phone. And what I liked about the kind of using a telephone conversation as a sort of a form of poem, almost like a letter poem in a way, is that we've all experienced that of being on the street and you hear one side of a conversation. And so in this poem, we hear Daphne complaining to her mum that she has taken the key yet again. And this is something her mum has done regularly. And so that Daphne is yet again locked outside. And it's a one-sided argument that we hear in the shape of the object that is being discussed, which is the key, which I just thought was a nice way of, again, further connecting the reader to the story. So we're talking about this object, and the key is such a lovely, as an ideal object for a shape poem to put into a book, because it's the right size. Yeah, so you're opening the page and you've got this key, which is the right size and shape of an actual key. So I liked that idea that you could almost put the key in the reader's hand. It just runs diagonally across two pages. So you've got the handle then running down into the key shape into the lower right-hand corner. Key. Yes, of course I checked. It wasn't there. No, because you used it yesterday because you forgot yours, remember? Yes, you did, Mum. You forgot it again. It's like the fifth time. And on Friday, yes, you did. You always do. Yes, you did. Dad wouldn't have forgotten. Nothing. Fine. Yeah, the library don't shut till 7. It's fine. Yes, I'm not hungry anyway. Okay, okay, okay. Yeah, I will. Yeah, I will. Yes, I said I will. Yes, I said I will. God. Okay, okay, okay. Bye.
I think we've all overheard one of those conversations.
Yeah, especially from a teenager.
And it is a very hopeful book, which I think is a very important message for children to have, because all the headlines can seem so negative for them.
Yeah, and I think it is particularly overwhelming for young people at the moment. I can't imagine what it must be like to have been studying for your GCSEs or for your A-levels, and then to be told that you were not doing the exams, and to have that interruption in your schooling, and just the social interruption of not seeing friends on a daily basis. For a lot of young people, school is an essential release, is a change, it's a very positive environment for them. So I really feel for young people at the moment during this difficult time.
And of course, libraries are another place where not only Daphne, but many other children can find solace. And I know that you are a passionate supporter of libraries and children's literacy.
Yes, I was very lucky to sort of get into poetry, firstly as a performance poet, but I was working with a organisation called Apples and Snakes, which is a performance poetry organisation, but they put poets into schools. And so for my first 12 years as a working performance poet, I got to work with amazing teachers up and down the country as a poet, but going in to work alongside them to find creative ways to encourage young people into literacy, to get them reading and writing. And this was all before I was published. And throughout my youth, libraries have always been very important. I took part in the summer reading scheme at my local library in Wandsworth, and would regularly go to my library to study with friends from my estate. And it was really an essential space. We didn't really have the room to study at home. It wasn't always quiet at home to study, but there was a library literally next door where me and my friends could go, and we had table space and we could spread out and we could talk to one another and do our homework and revise for our exams. And throughout my career, sort of working in schools and then as an author for these last 6 years now since I've been published, libraries have been absolutely key. I've toured theatre work to libraries. I've done many author events at libraries, and I took part in a library marathon, which I'm still involved with, actually. I gave myself the challenge of joining a library in every library authority in the UK. So there are 209 library authorities in the UK, and I wanted to see if I could join every single one. And to date, I've joined 140, but then lockdown happened. So that kind of scuppered about 70 odd left to do, which I plan on doing. I hope to finish those last 70 this year.
Wow, that's impressive. Now, we, of course, are very fortunate with the R&IB Library to have some of your books in there, including this year's World Book Day book that you wrote, which was Luna Loves World Book Day.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I have a real fond memories recording that and writing that. It was so wonderful. I've always wanted to have a World Book Day book because it's such a highlight on the publishing calendar to have this day dedicated to books and reading. And this idea that for many children, World Book Day books are the first book that they ever own. And I find that extremely powerful. So to have a book out there, which, you know, a child can get for free, or if they want to get several World Book Day books and they can get it for £1, you know, or indeed borrow it, you know, from a local library. Yeah, that was another dream come true.
Joseph Coelho, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of The Girl Who Became a Tree, and many congratulations.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And The Girl Who Became a Tree, a story told in poems by Joseph Coelho, is available from the R&IB Library.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The R&IB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles, and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer, or other reading devices. R&IB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished, and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format. Enjoy a selection of e-braille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for R&IB Reading Services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the Reading Services Library or any other of the great R&IB services we offer.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to the authors of The Library, A Fragile History, to hear the books of their lives, a few weeks ago, at the Wigtown Book Festival, Robert Kirkwood was introduced to an extraordinary true story.
Museum expert Rachel Morris had been ignoring the boxes under her bed for decades. When she finally opened them, an entire Bohemian family history was laid bare. Part memoir, part detective story, part untold history of museums. The book The Museum Makers, a journey backwards from old boxes of dark family secrets to a golden era of museums, is a fascinating and moving family story. The book's only available in print or as an e-book at the moment, but at the Wigtown Book Festival, I spoke to author Rachel Morris both about the book and the drive to make museums more accessible.
So I'm a person who has worked in museums for a long time, but I always knew I wanted to write about museums. And they're quite slippery, quite hard things to define. But eventually I decided that the essence of a museum is a place that tries to make order out of chaos. Human beings live in a kind of crazy universe, but museums are one of the places you go where somebody has said, and this happened, and this happened, and it happened because of this. And for me, there's something kind of quite romantic about the desire to make meaning out of chaos. And for me, that's the heart of the appeal of museums.
Now, the book talks about your shoeboxes under your bed that you ignored for decades. Do you think we've all got that sort of thing in our house?
I would have thought so, or most of us certainly. And they're both a kind of pleasure and a curse. And they're a pleasure because they're the past and we can look at them and we can be amazed. Most of us don't have very expensive things, so it's more like sort of old shoes and knitting needles and photos and diaries and just the bits and pieces of life. And most of us have them, but most of us don't know what to do with them. And so they tend to live in boxes, in our case, under the bed.
Now, I'll pick up on a very small line you gave during your talk at the Wigtown Book Festival, that you said there's great strides in making museums accessible. What sort of things does that involve?
Well, it kind of falls into a number of different ways. One way is that museums are definitely working harder to tell more stories about artefacts and to tell more engaging stories about artefacts. So there's this whole world now of museum interpretation where people are actually trained and work hard to put that kind of emotional and intellectual accessibility into museums. There's another layer of accessibility, which is physical accessibility. And that then falls into another set of questions. There is the physical accessibility that we all need, and then there's particular forms of accessibility required by different kinds of people according to their needs and situations. But generally, certainly compared with even 20 years ago or 10 years ago, museums are hugely aware now. It doesn't mean to say that we're all getting it right, but there's certainly an awareness there that it has to be thought about.
And you talked about the fact that some museums have a table out where you can touch artefacts, which of course is amazing for everyone, but particularly for blind and partially sighted visitors. What does it feel like when you touch objects like that?
Personally, and I think this is true of many, many people, but personally I find it quite magical. I love that sense of that direct connection to the past, and it's touch that gives it to you. Touch is a really special sense. Nothing, I think, takes you quite so directly into the past as to be able to touch something. I think it's partly because museums, on the one hand, they're quite overpowering and they're absolutely fascinating, but they do demand most of the time that you use your eyes. It's the dominant sense in a museum. And anything which rights that imbalance a bit and varies it is incredibly welcome to the visitors. So visitors love a bit of sound. Sometimes they love the opportunity to smell something. Just to use all their senses rather than that one dominant sense is a huge relief to any visitor, I think.
Have you ever had the experience of audio describing an exhibit?
Because all my inclinations are to write. I spend a lot of time just describing things in my head anyway. I'm a natural-born describer of things. Whether I do it well or badly is another question, but always there's a little voice in my head trying to describe something. When we make museums, we call in expert companies because there's a real expertise involved. And what you don't want to do is spend good money and get it wrong. Mm. So there are specialist companies who specialise in knowing how to respond to the visitor's needs. It also applies to children. You see, they're another group who have particular needs. And they too, you have to think about. You've got to think about everybody's needs here. Mm. And it's really only quite recently that people started to think, well, look, if we can't lower the showcases down to the level for the kids, then we're going to have to give them steps or something to get them up. Mm. And then you start to see the little set of footstools and so on that the children can stand on. Mm. So I don't think we're yet good at it, but we are certainly getting better.
The Museum Makers, a journey backwards from old boxes of dark family secrets to a golden era of museums, is available in ebook and print now.
Thanks, Robert. Now it's back to the authors of The Library, A Fragile History, for the books of their lives.
Andrew Pettigrew is a British historian and expert on the European Reformation, and Arthur de Vedevin is an Anglo-Dutch historian and writer, and together they co-authored The Library, A Fragile History. So together at the Wigtown Book Festival, I asked them for the books of their life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Well, one book that really stuck to me from childhood age that I've read several times, and every time I've realised new things and got new things out of it, would very appropriately on this theme would probably be Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose. Just this wonderful story about a labyrinthine library, and it's got a fantastic sort of series of puzzling murders to solve along the way. And it's got so many different layers of depth that the first time I read it, I was just amazed and astonished by the story. And then as I began to study history, I actually got many of the historical jokes a bit more. So every time I go back to it, there's something new I find there. And also from the perspective of writing this book on libraries, one of the things that stuck with me again is the sheer sort of oppressiveness of this particular library. That, you know, people sometimes go to libraries to solve all their problems, all the questions they might have. But sometimes, you know, you may find things that you don't even want to, you're not actually looking for. Mm. And that's something that really struck me for that book.
And beneath the feet of the ancients, and arched over them, and over the throne, and over the tetramorphic group, arranged in symmetrical bands, barely distinguishable one from another, because the artist's skill had made them all so mutually proportionate, united in their variety, and varied in their unity, unique in their diversity, and diverse in their apt assembly, in wondrous congruency of the parts with a delightful sweetness of hues, miracle of consonance and concord of voices among themselves dissimilar, a company arrayed like the strings of the zither, consentient and conspiring continued cognition through deep and interior force, suited to perform univocally in the same alternating play of the equivocal. Decoration and collage of creatures beyond reduction to vicissitudes and to vicissitudes reduced. Work of amorous connecting sustained by a law at once heavenly and worldly. Bond and stable nexus of peace, love, virtue, regimen, power, order, origin, life, light, splendour, species and figure.
Well, I don't cry very often. I did cry both the days when my children went to university. But the one book that has made me cry both times I read it was Jane Eyre. And I read it twice, I think about 30 years apart. And I think it's one of the great books ever written. There's a reason why it's number one in the Everyman Library. But strangely, these two aforesaid daughters who made me cry by going away from home both think that Jane is a wuss and should have stood up for herself. And it just shows that different generations react to books in totally different ways.
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning. But since dinner, Mrs. Reed, when there was no company, dined early. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so sombre and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight, with nipped fingers and toes, and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgiana Reed.
Both The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, narrated by John Livesey, and Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, narrated by Lucy Scott, are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again?
Well, the book that always continues to make me laugh and sort of cheer me up if I'm going to be picking up a light read would probably be Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall, which, especially when the protagonist gets sent to a very rainy part of the UK when a life in crisis and has to pick himself up again, and he continues to fall from that into many multiple misfortunes, and it always somehow that sadness always cheers me up.
"Sent down for indecent behaviour, eh?" said Paul Pennyfeather's guardian. "Well, thank God your poor father's been spared this disgrace. That's all I can say." There was a hush in Onslow Square, unbroken except by Paul's guardian's daughter's gramophone playing Gilbert and Sullivan in her little pink boudoir at the top of the stairs. "My daughter must know nothing of this," continued Paul's guardian. There was another pause. "Well," he resumed, "you know the terms of your father's will. He left the sum of £5,000, the interest of which was to be devoted to your education, and the sum to be absolutely yours on your 21st birthday. That, if I am right, falls in 11 months' time. In the event of your education being finished before that time, he left me with a complete discretion to withhold this allowance, should I not consider your course of life satisfactory. I do not think that I should be fulfilling the trust which your poor father placed in me if, in the present circumstances, I continued any allowance. Moreover, you will be the first to realize how impossible it would be for me to ask you to share the same house with my daughter."
There's a lot of books I wish I hadn't read, so I'd have the pleasure of rereading them. But to be absolutely honest, I very seldom read a book for the second time. Strangely, one of the ones I have done is I've read Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh twice, and apparently that is people's all-time favourite comfort book when they're asked.
"I have been here before," I said. I had been there before. First with Sebastian more than 20 years ago, on a cloudless day in June, when the ditches were creamy with meadow sweet and the air heavy with all the scents of summer. It was a day of peculiar splendour, and though I had been there so often in so many moods, it was to that first visit that my heart returned, on this, my latest. That day, too, I had come, not knowing my destination. It was 8th week. Oxford. Submerged now and obliterated, irrecoverable as lioness, so quickly have the waters come flooding in. Oxford, in those days, was still a city of aquitint. In her spacious and quiet streets, men walked and spoke as they had done in Newman's day. Her autumnal mists, her grey springtime, and the rare glory of her summer days, such as that day, when the chestnut was in flower, and the bells rang out high and clear over her gables and cupolas, exhaled the soft airs of centuries of youth. It was this cloistral hush which gave our laughter its resonance and carried it still, joyously, over the intervening clamour.
Decline and Fall by Evelyn Waugh, narrated by David Sinclair, and Brideshead Revisited, again by Evelyn Waugh, narrated by Greg Wagland, are both in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And what was something you've read recently that stuck with you?
Well, the book that I've just finished that stuck with me and it ensured I couldn't start a new book for several days after that was a book called The Forgotten Soldier by a Frenchman, Guy Sayer, which describes the experience of a French soldier in the German Wehrmacht in the Second World War. And it's probably the most harrowing book I've ever read about just an individual and groups of individual people stuck in war and with everything that involves. And it's truly harrowing.
After an official military welcome, we march into the walled court of this formidable fortress. In the courtyard, roll is called. Those who have already answered form another group, which grows larger as ours shrinks. The yard is jammed with every kind of military vehicle, and with 500 fully equipped soldiers who seem to be waiting for departure. We are sent off to our quarters in groups of 30. An old man calls to us, "Relief troops, this way." We conclude from this that the men massed by the trucks are leaving this regal habitation, which would explain their rather sullen faces. 2 hours later, I learn that their destination is somewhere in the immensity of Russia. Russia means the war, of which, as yet, I know nothing.
Well, my next book is going to be a book on books in wartime, so I've been reading a lot about the influence of books in war, and I've just read the most horrific book called The Junak King, about a young man who was an architect and found himself as a prisoner of war in Germany and becomes quite influential in his prisoner of war camp. But it's a beautifully written book, written by this man, would you believe, when he was 80.
Unfortunately, The Junak King, Life as a British POW, written by Sidney Litherland, isn't available in audio. However, The Forgotten Soldier, War on the Russian Front, a true story by Guy Sayer, is available in audio. It's narrated by Roger Davis and available commercially. And Arthur Devedevin and Andrew Pettigrew, authors of The Library, A Fragile History, thank you so much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.